This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
What I would like to spend a bit of time with you on, just to start off with, and then we can see where that goes, is developing the idea that the teaching of Torah that we do should in every instance be life-transforming. It should, when I say every instance, it doesn't always work out to be in every shiur. Sometimes you're working on an idea in a shiur and might take you a few shiurim to get to the life-transforming point, but if possible, it should be in each shiur. And it makes no difference with what level you're teaching. It doesn't matter whether you're teaching kids in a school, or whether you're teaching adults who've never learned before, or you're teaching some other from it. If what you're teaching is not life-transforming, then you've got to question whether you've understood it, never mind whether you've taught it well. The Gemara talks often, and Chaim Volozhin talks about it, how everything that we learn has to be with an almanas lasos, that everything that we do should have a practical implication. Everything we learn should be something that can be translated into practice. But we know that a lot of the things that we learn and teach don't necessarily have an immediate practical outcome. What I want to show you, share with you this afternoon, is how we can take a piece of technical Gemara, and I've chosen the first omid of Masechta Kiddushin, and teach it in a life-transforming way. So now imagine you're teaching the first Mishnah in Kiddushin, and you have secular Talmidim. You have Balabatim, who may never have learned Gemara before, or they may have learned a little bit of Gemara, and you're going to be teaching them Masechta Kiddushin. Part of the reason that I've chosen the first part of Masechta Kiddushin is because it's the part that Yeshiva Bochrim and the Achronim have a delightful time with. It's so technically complex. There's so much lomdus in it. There's so much excitement in it if one can relate to the lomdus. But what do you do with somebody who cannot? You're teaching somebody you can't do a difficult Rav Shimon on the concept of Kinyan Chalipin. You can't do a Ktos Achoshin on the concept of a Kinyan Kesef. They're not holding there yet. What are you going to do? How are you going to make this Gemara alive, vibrant, and life-transforming? So we'll go through it, and I'll give you some ideas as to how this can be done. One of there are a number of skills in Gemara teaching and learning that are really very important. What would you say some of the most important ones are? Apart from being able to read and translate, what would you say is one of the most important skills in the learning and teaching of Gemara? Sorry? To be able to get the pshat? Yeah. And what do you need? What kind of character trait do you need to be able to get the pshat? Not even to teach it, to learn. Just to understand it yourself. Honesty? Amazing honesty. That's true. Amazing honesty. What else? Openness. You've got to look at it as if you've never seen it before. And when are you likely to get the pshat? The first time you learn it? After how many times are you likely to get the pshat? At least four times. Like if you think you've got the pshat before four times, you haven't. So it's at least four times before you've got the pshat. But the problem is that after you've learned it two or three times, you start going over it by rote. And then you'll never get the pshat. So the art is to be able to retain your openness on the fourth time, and the fifth time, and the sixth time, to be able to look at it as if you've never seen it before, is very important, and very important in the teaching of it, because you're teaching it to somebody who might not have ever seen it before. I'm not even on them yet. So at the moment, we're still preparing the Gemara for ourselves. We're not even teaching it yet. So the first is honesty and being open. To be able to look at a Rashi, to be able to look at a few words of the Gemara as if you've never seen it before, because that's when your real discovery will come. The next thing that's important is, this you won't believe it's important for Gemara, but I'll show you how important it is. I think, I'm not even going to ask you to guess, because I don't think anybody would get it. If anybody would have got it, put up your hand, because that would be amazing. You need a sense of humor. You can't learn Gemara if you don't have a sense of humor. Because the Chachomim had a sense of humor, the Tanoim had a sense of humor, the Amoraim had a sense of humor. You've got to be able to have a sense of humor. You've got to notice when something's funny. You've got to notice when something looks odd. Because if you don't notice when something looks odd, you'll miss all the good parts of the Gemara. And you, part of how you notice when something looks odd is with a bit of a sense of humor. Now look how odd this is. Imagine you're going to learn what somebody hasn't learned before. So you're telling him you're learning Gemara. Do you know how to, if somebody asked you, what is Gemara, how would you define it? A commentary of the Mishnah? Okay. That wouldn't excite me. That wouldn't make me want to come and learn it. Give and take. That's nice. He's actually reconstructing the whole dialogue of the creation of Torah, which is an interesting one. I overheard somebody talking about me after I'd just given a lecture to a group of stockbrokers on the stock exchange. And when I'd finished, I just overheard. I was speaking to somebody, and behind me there were cocktails being served, and I was listening with one ear. One person said to another person who knows me, where did he get his doctorate? So this person said, no, he didn't. He hasn't got a doctorate. So he said, that's impossible. So where did he learn that from? So he said, he learned it from Gemara. So the other person's a goy, says, what is Gemara? Now I'm waiting to hear how this first person is going to explain that, because the first person knows nothing about Gemara. The first person is a Jewish that doesn't know anything about Gemara. And he said, Gemara is that which, if you've learned, you don't need to learn anything else. Okay, and that's what Gemara is. Gemara is that which, if you've learned, you don't need to learn anything else, because it contains within it all the wisdom that there is to know. That's what Gemara is. And if we don't see that in the learning, then we're not learning it properly, we're not teaching it properly. And that's perhaps the biggest challenge in learning. The talk today is called the Teaching Torah Chaim, to make it the Torah of life relevant, to make it something that gives a level of wisdom that when you finish with that, you think, if this is what I'm learning, I don't need to be learning anything else. This has got it all. So now you take this person who hasn't learned before, and you say, I'm going to learn Kiddushin with you. So he's going to say, what does Kiddushin mean? What would you answer? Marital law. So then I would say to you, now I'm being the person who hasn't learned Kiddushin. I thought, hasn't it got something to do with Kiddusha? With Kodesh? What's it to do with marriage? So what would you say? So you say, yeah, we are learning about Kedusha, we are learning about the sanctity of marriage, and how and what Kedusha means in marriage. That's how you explain what we're learning. Fine? Okay. So we're learning about marriage. So the first word of the Masechta is Ho'isha. That's okay. We're learning about marriage. I understand the first word is Ho'isha, the woman. What's the next word? Nikness. What does that mean? Is acquired is the way it's usually translated. If we want to be honest, how would we translate it? Is bought. Is bought. Because you know what the Gemara is going to care. What's the next one? Bishleisha drachim. Bekneis atma bishnei drachim. Nikneis be? Kesef. Okay. So this is no acquired. Acquired implies, you know, you can acquire with love. You can acquire with chuppah. You can kesef. So let's translate the word as it means. If we're going to translate, if we're going to get it accurately, you open up this Masechta called Kiddushin, sanctity, and it starts with Ha'isha, Niknes, Bishloisha Drachim. There are three ways to acquire a woman. There are three ways to buy a woman. Kesef, Shtar, cash, money, Shtar, a check, document, and Bil, sexual relationships. Those are the three ways to do it. Now, here's where the sense of humor comes in. That's a very funny way to start a Masechta. It's a very funny way to start any Masechta. It's a very funny way. It's a funny thing to be anywhere. It's brazen to try that. Even in a non-feminist environment. Can you imagine trying this in a feminist environment? What does this mean? Are you a nickname? So we're talking about buying? No, when I say humor, it's not to create humor for the purpose of laughing at it. When I say humor, it's that humor alerts you to the fact that there's something going on underneath the surface that isn't immediately evident. That's really what humor is. That it alerts you to deeper levels of meaning. So when you see this, you realize Chazal are trying to do something here. This is a very strange way to phrase it. Because with the humor you ride right over, without the humor you ride right over. You then look at this and say, my goodness, this is really funny. To start off, Kiddusha, the Isha, nickname, something so commercial. A Masechta called Kiddushin, the sanctity of marriage. What do you think we would start with? You would think sanctity, Kiddushin, marriage. The Ribbono Shel Olam and the mother and the father are all shutfin, all partners. And when a man and a woman get married, the Shechina is present. That's what you would think it would say. That's what people would want to hear. To start off a Kiddushin, a Masechta about the sanctity of marriage with the fact that a woman is bought with cash. That's the first, that means that is the first you say, that's where you start from. Everything else you develop from there, the very first thing to know is a woman is bought with cash. And appreciate the irony. Perhaps irony is even better than irony and paradox and than human. Not human in the funny sense, but human in the odd. Oh, this is weird. This needs exploration. This is so unusual. This is so strange. What does this word mean, this nickness? And what is it telling us? So Isha nickness. But the first, just let's stop there before we even get on to Kesa. The idea that a woman is purchased, is that an idea that demeans the meaning of a woman and the meaning of a marriage? It would seem yes. If we're honest, yes, it would seem demeaning. What does it mean? And we know that can't be right. Why would the Torah would never demean marriage and would never demean women? So what does it mean? What is the nature of that? The word nicknames we translate it as bought. There's another English word that we could also use, which will give us a whole new meaning and understanding. Not acquired, because that's too paravan. But the other word that we could use, let me go a little bit further in the Gemara before we get to that. You know how the Gemara starts. Ha'isha nicknames, ma'ishna hofi the tani ha'isha nicknames, or ma'ishna hosan the tani ha'ish mekadish. The Gemara starts, gets onto it. Now normally when this is taught, it's taught just as a technical question. In the Mishnah further on Daf Mem Aleph, it says, a man can be Mekadesh a woman, either himself or with a shliach. So why doesn't it say, Ha'isho miskadeshes, instead of Ha'isho nikneis? We see that Mekadesh is a word that's used. It's Masechta is called Kiddushin. We're talking about sanctity. For goodness sake, use the word Kiddushin. Why nikneis? Why introduce commas in the first line of the Mishnah? So the Gemara is asking it even stronger. The Gemara is not just asking it from a philosophic point of view, but even from a textual point of view, because in the Mishnah on Daf Mem Aleph, we do that. So not as if we can't do that, we can do that, and we do it. Why not use that word? The Gemara is using the context of that Mishnah to ask a question, but what the Gemara is worried about is this word. Why use a word like nickness? Answer the Gemara. Mishum de koboi lemisni kese, because one of the three ways is money. The chesef minalan, and how do you know that money works? The Gemara says that right here makes it even worse. Gomar kicho kicho misday Ephraim. We know that money works because of the way that the fields of Ephraim were bought by Avram. Siv halcha ki yikach ish isho. It says in the Torah if a man should take a wife. Siv hosom nosaki kesef asor ekach mimeni, and Avram says, well, here's the money for the field, take it from me. So we see that kicho, the word kicho, just as it works by a field, it works by a woman. The kicho ikra kinyan. And kicho is another word for kinyan, for acquisition, for purchase. Look to be lokeach. We call a lokeach is a buyer. Kicho means to buy. And to be koine means to buy. Same word. And because we're using kesef, we're using the word kinyan. So the Gemara is making it worse. The Gemara is saying, you're right. We could have said ha isho miskadeshes. But we want to throw up in your face the fact that we're dealing with a financial transaction. And if we're dealing with a financial transaction, let's get the mysticism out of the way and deal with the economics of it. And that's where we start. And that makes it even more bland. So now the issue becomes even bigger. So the Masechta is starting with the economics of a transaction that is called marriage. And everything else comes later, but that's the starting point. The word that I thought that we could use instead of purchased, acquired, no? Instead of acquired, and instead of purchased as well, could be invested in. Okay? Nowadays in marketing, they like to use that word. They don't say buy a Mercedes-Benz, they say invest in one. Because people prefer to invest than to buy. I don't know why, but they feel better about an investment. It's the same thing. but it has a slightly different connotation to it. So how it would be if we now translate this, ha'isha niknes, a woman is invested in one of three ways. Okay, still the meaning? The same as with the sode. When you buy a field, what is the difference between investment and purchase? Let's have a look at that for a moment. Why do we learn you invest in property? What's the parallel? Let's explore that for a moment. What is the parallel between property and a woman? And why is that not the meaning? What did you want to say? Don't think so. I don't think so. All we have is purchase, because in truth, an investment is a purchase. If you're buying something that is long-lasting, it's an investment. If you're buying something that is a consumer item, you would say it's a purchase. But if you're buying something that is long-lasting, it's an investment. But there's more of that in the implication of investment. What is that? Yes, by investing, you're becoming a bailim, you have an ongoing relationship with what you've invested in. You don't invest in something and then withdraw. You purchase. You're cultivating, you're nurturing, you're nourishing. Absolutely. Absolutely. What happens to a field if you don't take care of it? It deteriorates. That's what the nature of property. Ask any landlord, what happens to a property you don't take care of? It doesn't stay the same as when you bought it. If you buy a diamond and you put it away in the safe, and you take it out 50 years later, the diamond's the same as it was when you bought it. If you buy a field and you don't take care of it for 6 months, or a building, and you don't take care of it for 6 months, what's left? Already deteriorating. That's the nature here. So we're beginning to learn of what a man does when he marries. Don't worry about what the woman does at the moment. We're talking about what the man does. You see, because in Lashon HaKodesh, in the Torah, a man and woman don't get married. Isn't that so? A man marries a woman. A woman doesn't do anything. And that's why we don't allow women to give rings under the chuppah. This is not about a man and a woman getting married. There's no such thing as getting married. It's a man marrying a woman. It's like there's no such thing as a field and an owner getting together. An owner buys a field. That's what it is. You purchase. There's no such thing as a field and an owner get together. So it is with a man and a woman. If the act is one of investment on the part of the man. And what are we learning? That the investment is the same as a sode. The idea of a sode is that if the investment isn't taken care of, the investment deteriorates and you'll end up losing. You'll end up with less than you had before. So that's a bad deal. You'll end up losing on the deal. What is a more appropriate word to use for a husband? Baal or Adon? Where do we use the word Baal and where do we use the word Adon? An owner of a slave, what is he? He's an Adon. And a Baal HaSode. Right? You own a field, it's Baal. You own a slave, it's Adon. So just stepping back a moment, which would you say is the more appropriate one? Why? Is a woman more like a slave or like a field? Leaving aside the Gemara. You would say for humans you use Adon, and for objects you use Baal. If you have an animal, you have a Baal. If you have a human being, you're an Adon. So if this is some kind of human ownership, one would be an Adon, not a Baal, but we're not. We're Baal, we're not Adon. What's the difference between a Baal and an Adon? What is the difference in concept between a Baal and an Adon?
I don't know which
kind of Adon you're talking about.
Good.
He has a natural time limit involved. Okay, that's a good difference. There's another difference too, and that is that in the case of an Odin, where is there more responsibility, in a Baal or an Odin? A Baal. So what we're talking about here is a relationship, the marriage relationship is a relationship of enormous responsibility on the part of the man to the woman. Enormous responsibility. Let's go a step further. So what we're saying now is Ha'isha, that what the mission is now telling us right up front is a woman has to be invested in. That's what marriage is. Marriage is investment. Now we're beginning to understand. But before we get on to the esoteric stuff about the Kabbalah and all the mystical stuff and all the spiritual stuff, get what it really is. Get the responsibilities right. The first thing to understand is this is an investment, and you become a Baal, and if you don't take care of your investment, you're going to lose an awful lot. That's the first thing we learn. The next thing we learn is, by the way, I must tell you that if you're in a kehillah sometime in the future, and you want to give a Gemara shiur to the men, one of your problems is going to be the women. Because when a man gets into Gemara and he starts enjoying it, he starts putting time into it. It's like golf, lahavdil. And the women sometimes find that difficult. So what is very good is, when soon after you've started your Gemara shiur, is invite the women to one Gemara shiur and teach them, but this is what we're just doing now. And you'll find them saying, if that's what my husband's coming to learn, that as long as you just keep him as many hours as you want, then they understand the value, making him a better person, a better husband. Now, let's look at it at one step further. Why then, Bekesef Bishtaruvir, why is the first thing that's mentioned is Bekesef? Let's look at these three kinyonim. There's the kinyon Kesef, which is money. There's the kinyon Shtar, which is the legal document. And there's kinyon Bia, which is a sexual relationship. What is the nature of those three kinyonim? Why these three kinyonim, and what does each one mean? What the Torah is telling us here is that this investment into a woman takes place on three levels. The one is financial, which we're going to discuss in detail in a moment. The other is shtar, is verbal. Shtar means clarity. Documentation means very clear communication. When a lawyer draws up a document, he tries to make it as unambiguous as possible, unless he wants to make it ambiguous. But the absolute clear, good document is a document that's absolutely clear. And that's a shtar. The part of the way of investment is clear communication. And the third one is a physical and an emotional relationship. Those are the ways that a man invests in a woman. Now, one of the things you'll teach us, we said that this has to be life-transforming, is not just the technicalities of kinyonim. That's one part. If you're teaching Talmidei Chachomim, you'll do that. And you'll do that with your Balavatim as well. But the other part is to understand that there's an idea, Reb Shimon Shkof has an idea in Lomdus, which we can develop into the psychology of it as well, that the kinyan of marriage takes place every moment of the marriage, not just under the chuppah. It's an ongoing, you initiate it under the chuppah, and it's an ongoing, you're reacquiring your wife every moment. It's not a one-off deal. And the idea here is, conceptually, is exactly that the investment is an ongoing investment, an ongoing focus, an ongoing awareness on three levels simultaneously. Now, let's start with Kesef. What would you say is the most important middah that a husband has to have in a marital relationship? Most important characteristic? Patience, okay. What else? Responsibility. Initial investment. Somebody has to start the process. And part of what the Mishnah is telling us is it's not for the woman to start it. For the man to start it, and one of the tools he uses to start the emotional relationship is kesef. He invests with money. He puts money into her. He buys her things. He supports her. Takes care of her financially. That's one of the first things that sets off any kind of relationship. Yeah. You're right. You see a total role reversal, but you also see a few other interesting things. You see a 44% divorce rate, and you see a singles community size bigger than has ever been before in the history of Western man. Because marriages are no marriages. Because there's a confusion of our reversal of roles can still work. And she becomes a man, and he becomes a woman, and if that works for them, then that's fine. There are all sorts of other problems that result from that. But the confusion of roles is one of the biggest problems. And that confusion of roles starts at the first date. When he doesn't treat her like a woman at the first date, that's when the problem starts. And with all the feminism and with all the independence, women still like to be treated as women. A woman likes to be able to pay for her own dinner, but not to have to. That's what she likes ideally. To be able to, I don't need your money, but I enjoy the fact that you want to take me out. A man should not enjoy that. A man should feel impotent if the girl says, I know you can afford, I want to take you out. And the second date she again says, you know, I took you out last time. It was nice. I want to do it again. I don't want you to pay. A man should feel that should be a problem for a man. It shouldn't be a problem for a woman. should make a woman feel very good, because that's the nature of the kinyan. The kinyan is he invests money in her. That's natural, that's normal, that's how the Rebbeinu created us. And you're right, we're dealing in a complex environment today where there are all sorts of subtle and sometimes not so subtle plays on that theme, and one has to examine what does that do to the kinyan of marriage. How does it leave the man, and how does it leave the woman? How does it leave the male ego? And how does it leave the woman's need to be taken care of and to feel taken care of, irrespective of the feminism? So one of the very first acts of investment then becomes the kinyan kesef. And what is he doing under the chuppah? What's he actually doing when he gives her a ring? So, but apart from the words, what he's actually doing is taking money, taking cash, gold, and it has to be something which is convertible, and he's giving it to her, he's investing it in her. You know, the Gemara gets onto whole questions of how much money. And what does the Gemara say? What's the minimum amount? A pruta. A shove pruta is all that it has to be. How does that work? So a shove pruta is a cent. What are you going to do? You're going to give it to yourself. I really want to invest in you, my love. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I think you're a woman of incredible value. And I would like you to accept my proposal of marriage, and I hereby invest in you, and you give her 1 cent. What does that mean? And what happens if you give her a Rolex watch? Sorry? No, it might not count. Okay, that might be a king of Khalifin, that might be another kind of kinyan that might not count. So you could give her a $5,000 Rolex watch and it doesn't count, and you can give her 1 pruta and it does count. What's all that about? Because the vehicle of investment is cash. The vehicle of investment is something that can grow. If you give somebody a Rolex watch 10 years later, what is it? It's still a Rolex watch. If you invest a cent 10 years later, what is it? It depends how the stock exchange is doing. It could be 0.5 cent, it could be 20 cents. It grows. That's what investment is. Investment is putting in and understanding what you're really saying is that the reason I'm investing in you, and that's the difference between giving and investing. The reason I'm investing is because I believe that whatever I put into you will be worth much more in time to come. Because you are a growing being. That's what investment means. Investment is an act of confidence in the future. Isn't that though? You only invest in something which you believe will be worth more tomorrow than it is today. Otherwise you don't invest in it. So by investing in a woman under the chuppah, what are we doing? We're saying, I believe that you and everything I put into you will be worth more tomorrow than it is today. That's an act of confidence. That's what generosity means. Yeah. Right, so that's we come on to Shtar now.
No, but I'm saying, you say, I can invest in that and see that practice.
Because that's a different kinyan. Now we move on to a different kinyan. The one way to acquire a woman is to invest financially in her. There's another way to acquire a woman, and that is through verbal communication. And a shtar, again, technically a shtar means a legal document, but it's quite interesting. You will find any woman who has an ounce of romance in her will still have the letters that her husband wrote to her before they were engaged. Why? They're precious. They're very, very precious. The words, the things that he wrote, very, very meaningful. And shtar is communication. It's written communication. So on the technical side, it just means a legal marriage document. That taking our idea that what the Mishnah is teaching us here is life-transforming principles and that they're ongoing. What the Torah is saying here, don't stop the love letters after you get married. And not just value, special appreciation, value, confidence in the future, desire to be building together. And so you're investing verb, absolutely. You're investing who you are, or you're putting yourself at risk, you're opening yourself, you're being vulnerable, you're exposing yourself, you're investing yourself in each one of those. Because there is an assumption, just as generosity can sometimes stop after they get married, so does communication sometimes stop. Certainly emotive communication. And you find the husband and wife are landing up communicating about where the tomatoes are cheaper and what yushita is available and what school to send the kids to. And that's got nothing to do with marriage. That's the practicalities of running a home, but that's got nothing to do with the kinyan between man and wife. So the Mishnah is alerting us. There's another kinyan, shtar. There's a question of the clarity of communication. And then the third one is bio, the absolute importance that the Torah places on a healthy and a functioning and a gratifying and meaningful physical relationship between man and wife. As important as the financial investment, as important as the communication, is that those three things need to be in place. And if in a marriage you find those three in place, say you'll get, if you get into Rabbonus, all your marriage counseling comes from this mission. If you can set those three things, if a person's having problems, and you can set those three things in place, that he's generous, that he's communicative, and that there's a good physical relationship, everything else can be taken care of. There's hardly anything else that will get in the way if those three things are steady and are firm and well in place. So here you have an example of taking a dry piece of Gemara, Mishnah, and you extend this through the sugya as the Gemara goes on, teaching it to somebody who might never have learned Gemara before, in a way where he says, my goodness, if this is what Gemara is all about, I'd better learn some more, because this can change the way I live. And there is not a sugya that I can think of that you can't do this with, anywhere in the whole of Shas. Of course you can do it in Chumash as well, and you need to do it in Chumash if you learn, if you're teaching the psukim of Stei Ephron. It's a very nice thing when you're teaching the psukim of Stei Ephron to bring this in. It doesn't have to be that you only teach the Chumash in terms of the context of the psukim in terms of the storyline. Sometimes when you want to make the Chumash a life-changing event, you use the Gemara, certainly the Midrashim and sometimes the Gemara on that as well. So terribly important in the process of teaching that the two things are kept in alignment. That is the technicality of accurate learning, because if you don't do that, then you can go drifting off into crazy places. And you can, if your technical learning isn't good, then you can create a philosophy which has nothing to do with the Torah, and you can pin it onto Chazal. That's not what you want to be doing. You want to be going through the Chazal very clearly, being able to interpret and explain it in a way that is technically accurate, and expanding it and extrapolating it from its technical accuracy into philosophic meaningfulness that makes a person understand and relate to it as something very relevant to his life and to his life force, not something that's abstract and something that's technical and something that's academic and not meaningful to him. Are there any questions and comments on that? And let's, we can move wider afield as well, sure. You see, once the person is hooked in to the relevance of it, then that becomes much easier for him to go through and to work out. Yes, and then you can, by summarizing it and by analyzing their ways to present it. But the two things he begins to find very fascinating. The one is the technical give and take, just the way the theory is built up and is analyzed and is examined, he begins to find meaningful. And in every kasha and in every teret, in every question and answer, you should seek out the philosophic component. So that as you build the sugya, when I teach kiddushin, this theme that I've just given to you now, we build right through almost all of the first teret. We keep on coming up, we answer Tosafot's questions with it, we explain difficult Rambams with it. As you develop the principles, these philosophic principles become tools that you use in all sorts of little corners afterwards, so you don't let up on it, even in Shakya Vatsaya. It happens sometimes, occasionally, you've got a long thing that you've just got to go through in order to get to the other end, and then you might consider shortening it, and you might consider giving them a kind of a summary of it instead of taking them all the way through it. But usually that's not necessary. Usually if you've got them hooked in by getting them this way, they're in. And they want to know and they want to understand. Every machlokes, it's important to understand. When there's a machlokes, whether it's in the Mishnah or the Gemara, to understand not only what their longish differences are, but to understand the philosophic consequences of each person's halakhic viewpoint and how that would impact on our life. But now it becomes intriguing to the Talmud. If that's the case, we'd better find out who's right, because it makes a difference. We better find out how we pass them, because it makes a difference to my life. Starts becoming relevant. So again, it makes a difference in brachos and sukkah and Shabbos and Bava Metzia, Bava Kama, Kedushin, Ksubas, Zvachim, Kodshim, wherever you are. The same thing applies. Try and extract the principle.
When one thing is has a fear of shock, and then start to delve into any hear you listen to this, it doesn't have. I mean, there it is. So, you're going through, you're thinking about pressure, sky, idea, what it means, what it means. But you're coming up with your own things that you know are consistent with your shuffle, and, you know, it doesn't stray from it. At what point do you feel confident, like, you've got to keep this track, because, I mean, whatever, how does one gauge this, and how much time does one put into working out all the elements?
That's wrong to think that it's not quick at all. Ashir, once you know the Gemara well, until you're really good at it, should take you another 4 hours to prepare. Because now you're preparing these kind of things and how you're going to present it. It doesn't always work, one doesn't always have that kind of time. Sometimes you've got to cut it short. But ideally, that's the right kind of ratio that you need for an hour's shiur. You need 4 hours preparation after you know the Gemara already. And the Vilna Gaon has a smach for it. He says that you've got two eyes and you've got two ears and you've only got one mouth. Which means you should take in four times as much as you put out. For every hour of output, you should have 4 hours of input. And that helps avoid burnout. One of the big professional risks of chinuch and rabbonis is burnout. And that can happen very young. It can happen very quickly. And there are different forms of burnout. There's social and emotional burnout by just dealing with a lot of people and their problems. And there's intellectual burnout by teaching more than you're learning. That you're not just not input, you're not refreshing yourself. And it's very important that in your teaching there's chidush, that there's something that excites you, the teacher. So if you're not busy with Kiddush in the sugya itself, the learning is unlikely to be enthusing to the Talmud. And for you to have Kiddush in the sugya, you need some hours of preparation. So it's again, with the pressures of time, it's not always that easy to structure it that way. But if one can, you just try and structure enough time, and then the teaching becomes very meaningful to you as well, because you grow much more out of it. If you're just preparing the Gemara to give it an hour's time, and then tomorrow you're doing the same, and it's just from hand to mouth, and you're just learning and teaching and learning and teaching, where's your growth? Where are you stretching yourself? So yes, it does take a long time. Where that point of confidence comes is difficult to know. The real way to do it is to say it over to your Rebbe in the beginning, until you start realizing that you're getting it right, he's accepting it. That's probably the best test of being okay and ready with it. Because you will be saying things that are new, bringing new angles onto it. You want to be sure, two things you want to be sure, that the philosophy that you're teaching is consistent with Torah Hashkofa, and that it's the meaning that it works. That you're not just creating ideas in the air and linking it onto the Gemara, that actually that it's consistent, that it explains that it works right through the sugya. And you must be ready to abandon it if it doesn't. Sometimes you go through too deep into it and you realize that it isn't working. And you abandon it. Part of the honesty of learning is to abandon. Yeah. This you can teach off the street.
To continue, and this would be enough to get them to come back next week.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Not everybody, but generally, it's a mind opener, because they then see Gemara as a key to life. And whether you carry on with the same sugya or you do something else and choose a few sugyas to get them into it first, those are two different approaches, but both of them work. Yeah.
You said it helped the man actually go over this with the woman. Would you ever combine the two together at the same time, at the beginning?
It's a very interesting thing that very seldom works well. And that's the thing in shiurim in general, quite apart from any questions of tznius, I've always found that if I'm teaching women and men separately, even if I'm teaching them the same subject matter, I can teach them on the same level. And sometimes I can teach the women on a deeper level than the men. When you put them together, the level is lower than sort of the lowest common denominator kind of level, because you're trying to balance different approaches. The men are much more abstract than the women. Women always want the, and this is what we've learned now, it hasn't been that abstract, that's something that women could take. But usually there's a, and particularly when you're dealing with matters of marriage, there's a lot of advantage in doing it separately. They will ask things, they will talk about things, they will bring up things that they don't feel comfortable
bringing up within a mixed group. So I generally don't. I generally would not bring them together. Yeah.
Would you say that the very staple would be, something like Pirkei Avos, because of all the commentary and how the commentary is really has a lot of Torah's kind in it. But you're saying something different than just that. You're saying every piece of Torah across the board, right? So is that, if you take Pirkei Avos for example, then it shouldn't really be a question that you should be able to do this.
Absolutely. And you take Pirkei Avos, you take some Rambam, or you take Tanakh, or you take Mishnah Sishori, and you can, that's easy, because that's what it's all written about.
You're talking about the challenge of doing it.
That's it. Yeah. That's it, because and for a few reasons. Number one, this accesses a different part of the other person, because there's intellectual rigor here. This is not just a nice saying, it's a motto. There's intellectual rigor. As they get into a sugya, they start seeing their mind working, and they're called upon to use their mind in a very interesting way, because Gemara is not linear. And anybody who has a secular education is trained to think in a linear way. So there's enormous value when they start understanding. That's another thing that you teach, is the method of reasoning, Gemara, and how this is different to secular reasoning. How Gemara is spherical reasoning. You start in the middle and you're going out in all sorts of directions at the same time. And what that does to the human being's creative ability. So an intelligent person becomes very connected with the challenge of learning, and there's this overlay of meaning as he's going through it. That's very seductive for a person. So I think, obviously, these are the things, if you're stuck with something to say, or you've only got a short time with a person, you can't get into Gemara, then those things are great. But if you can have a chance, if somebody's willing to give an hour a week to come to a Gemara share, then you have an opportunity to transform their life.
Do you say that anything works for everyone, or you have to pick and choose topics? Let's say, for example, what about topics when learning about Daniel Melman's disclosure, imagine, or something like that, but you have to choose, say, okay, this girl would be interested.
You're right. Generally, for example, as far as women are concerned, even I very seldom do any Gemara with them, except about Gadot. Because it gets too, they don't like going down lanes of intellectual exploration. They want stuff that it's got to be something that's practical, that has relevance. And even with men, you're right. You would select it. I've never found a difficulty in making a good piece of Gemara exciting for anybody. So. But whatever it is, but sometimes it will be easier to choose something. You'll say it's particularly for beginners. You might say something like this is relevant to everybody, so why start with something that isn't that relevant to everybody when you can start with something that is relevant to everybody? So you might start with this rather than with brachas. But we have another session together, don't we? What I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to give you homework to do. I'm going to ask you to prepare another sugya like this, and then we'll see what you do with it for tomorrow.
Is it possible to judge whether the person you're teaching is really taking and learning, or if he's just sitting there and being entertained by this wonderful,
Yeah, you'll judge very easily. You'll judge when he starts putting in time in preparation. And that can take a few days, or it can take a few weeks, and it can take a few years before all of a sudden he says, I just want to be better at this. I want to master this. And he starts putting in time for preparation. I have a kehillah, the kehillah that I came to in California, it was a kehillah that had an incredible love for learning, but I call it jacuzzi learning. Jacuzzi is when the water goes past you so that you feel as if you're swimming. You're sitting still, the water's moving, and you feel as if you're swimming. So the jacuzzi learning is like you feel as if you're learning. You're sitting still, the rabbi is talking, and you feel as if you're learning. So one of the first challenges I had was to transform it from jacuzzi learning into real learning. And the way we did it was with a Gemara share. And what happened within a period of less than 6 months, the 1 hour a week of share, which used to be literally that, it was 10 to the hour, listen and go home, has turned into an average 8 hours. That the average person is putting in 8 hours of preparation for the hour. And these are very busy people. These are very busy, living very, very busy lives. It's quite amazing what they're doing. This is on their own, with text, they're doing their own. So that's the point at which that transition, when you notice that this is no longer just listening to this very intellectual stuff. And that's another advantage with teaching Gemara, that there's no real free riding. If they don't enjoy it, if they're not getting into it. So if you've got somebody who wants the free ride, then you do the free overs and the Midrashim and the Parashim and things like that, and they get a nice, they get valuable input without terribly much work. But if you think this is somebody who could get involved in serious learning, Gemara forces that to happen. And if the Gemara, if the lesson is the sheer is fun, he will want to master it, he will want to come prepared. Because Gemara is, I think that Gan Eden and Gehenim is the same place. And I think Gan Eden and Gehenim is a Gemara shir. That's all it is. For those who are prepared, it's Gan Eden. For those who are not prepared, it's Gehenim. And if you give a good Gemara shir, nobody wants to be in Gehenim.